Okay, we're now being recorded.
Yeah, so if everyone can mute their phone by pressing *6, then it'll be we'll be able to hear Joseph more clearly. And when questions and answers time comes, you can unmute. Press
Is that also *6?
*6, yeah.
For both of them.
So I'm really, I don't want to say too much, although I could say tons about Joseph and his work and commitment and brilliance and friendship, but we want to leave as much time as possible for those of you who are able to get online to see a little taste of what the Cancer Project is and its scope. You could open up your internet and see that, wix.com, Cancer Stories. But Joseph, did you want to put people on somehow to a PowerPoint?
No, that's not going to happen.
Okay. So I think this is a very special project, and there is a kind of multi-dimensional aspect to what Joseph's been doing, because it's a project which he'll explain is really created by a university to develop modules to train doctors. But it's really combining storytelling and medicine in a unique way. And it has some aspects that for us are incredibly interesting, which I'm sure Joseph will really discuss. And one of those is that the interviews that are conducted, so basically doctors can actually understand what patients are actually experiencing, what their needs are, what their experience of the medical profession is. It's very, very moving and very powerful. At the same time, for the people who are being interviewed, they are in essence giving creating a narrative and a new context in which to see their illness.
Right.
So I think that it's a lot based on listening and really developing what we think of as pretty innate, but in a sense we have to really learn again and again, which has to do with compassion. So I'm just going to turn it over to Joseph, who's going to speak for about a half hour, and then we can ask questions, and he's kindly here to answer them.
Interesting. So, I've never lectured to a phone before, but thank you, Laura, for inviting me, and thank you to all the folks who are joining in, at least two of whom I know have already been involved with the project, have given interviews to the project, one of whom has been portrayed on stage by someone other than herself. I don't know, Diane, did you ever see the play that we did with the stories, including yours?
I just saw it CD that you, or DVD you sent me. I didn't see it live.
Right. Okay. Well, let me start with the pieces of the puzzle as they arrange themselves to begin with. The project, to give the big overview, is part of a $1.5 million National Institutes of Health, National Cancer Institute grant given to this working group at ETSU, which consists of oncologists, family medicine practitioners, and storytellers, including me and a number of very talented graduate assistants who have worked on the project and have done a lot of the legwork and hard work of transcribing, coding interviews, and actually giving the interviews, I mean recording the interviews and listening to the patients tell their stories. So it's a big group, and it was brought together, actually it's the product of the traditional 7 years of labor in the wilderness. We started, I think, back in 2002 or 3, and the person who brought the group together was a man with a public health background named Bruce Berenger, who was the head of the Rural Health Partnership Program at ETSU, which was started many years before I got there, again on a Kellogg Foundation grant, to create interesting ways of bringing the medical school curriculum to the community and bringing the community to the medical school. Bruce was brilliant at bringing people together, both people within the university structure who you wouldn't think would ordinarily be working together in that kind of very separated environment, but also community members of all kinds, church people, veterans groups, all kinds of community organizations, arts groups, and storytelling he really got. He's one of the people at the university, not in the little storytelling ghetto that we have there, who actually understands the way storytelling connects different disciplines, different groups of people. It's a kind of a universal solvent for people to listen to each other and hear each other. And Bruce really got that. So he brought this group together with storytellers, oncologists, public health people, family medicine people, and particularly a man named Forrest Lang, who is a medical communications specialist. He's a family doc, but he's spent his career working on teaching medical students and residents to listen, to really listen to patients. And Forrest is also someone who really got the value of storytelling as a method, not storytelling so much, but story listening, to really encourage the patients to tell their stories, both as a diagnostic tool, because when you listen to patients tell stories, you hear things about their lives, things about their experience, things about their levels of health and the places where that health breaks down. You hear about their environments, you hear about their habits, lifestyle issues, stress issues, family issues, all kinds of things that have bearing on health. So, I think in storytelling a lot there's sort of a disconnect sometimes between the storytelling discipline that involves performance, telling, and the storytelling discipline that involves listening and facilitating. And this particular project is very much focused on the listening side. But I'll also tell you about the part of it where we take our listening and turn that into performance. You know, there's a reciprocal relationship there. Anyway, we worked on this project, on this grant proposal, for 7 years, just starting off sitting in a room and asking, what can storytelling and medicine say to each other? And the first question is, what is the problem that the medical people really want to resolve or address with the grant? And what we heard again and again was, we want to be better at breaking bad news. We want to be better at helping patients make decisions about treatment from the various options that are available to them, decisions that come authentically from the patient and from their partnership with the physician. There's this thing called patient-centered care, which is fairly hot right now in medical circles, and the patient-centered care means really listening to what the patient's values, beliefs, feelings, and letting that have a bearing on the decisions that are made in the treatment process. So, breaking bad news in a sensitive way, living through treatment and making decisions that are authentic and in accord with patients' values, and finally, dealing with end of life issues, dealing with a transition from treatment to palliative care and planning and preparing for end of life and for dying, or for recovery and looking back on the experience in some genuine heartfelt way, so that the experience is integrated into an ongoing sense of self. And when I heard those concerns or those pieces of the medical narrative, my association right away with that was, well, you've just described the hero's journey. You've just described Joseph Campbell's model of the mythic narrative, which consists of separation, or in the medical narrative, that's breaking bad news when you just something comes between you and the habitual course of your life, some shadow, some irrevocable experience that you then have to change your life in order to deal with. And that's the breaking bad news. That's the call to adventure in Campbell's terms. And then living through treatment is called the road of trials. The journey to the other world, because the medical world, the world of treatment, the world inside the hospital or the outpatient clinic where you're being transfused with deadly chemicals, is somehow a very modern translation of the road of trials. And finally, that the return or the reincorporation or the transition to another life, all of that is straight out of the hero's journey. And when I expressed that to the doctors, there was this kind of moment of silence, like, oh, so that's it. You know, because there's a sense that you get kind of habituated to the medical model of experience. But there's also, at the root of it, something enormously mythic that goes way back to, you know, Hermes and Asclepius and the ancient mysteries of healing. But those mysteries, again, you know, the more mysterious our medical system gets, the more habitual and mundane and technological and divorced from the magic of it. And somehow the giving the narrative model of myth was a real moment of kind of hair standing on end there in the room. And it became the format for the grant, really, and the format for the interview process that we devised. Now, we applied, as I say, it took 7 years to actually get the big grant, and we applied 3 times. So all the mythic laws were obeyed, you know, the cycle of 7 and the cycle of 3. And the first two grant proposals were turned down with steadily increasing scores and feedback that said, change this and change that, and we changed this and we changed that. And the third time, we got the grant, and I found out about it at an internet cafe in Bhutan, where I'd gone for this conference with the prince, you know, the crown princess of Bhutan, and all these monks and incredible scholars. Talking about Bhutanese folklore in the middle of the Himalayas, and I went to a little internet cafe in Thimphu and got the message we'd gotten the grant. And the same month, my father was diagnosed with cancer. So we were already into the interview process, but my father became one of the people that we interviewed twice. And I got to go through that process of caring for him according to the narrative of the hero's journey, you know, the breaking of bad news, the decisions that were made about treatment, and finally the resignation to a terminal outcome and all the wrenching process of letting go that was involved with that. So it became very much my own journey, as well as sharing the journey with about 100 other patients, listening to doctors talk about their journeys and their challenges and their issues with cancer and listening and working on these modules. The modules were the takeaway, you know, for the grant. They were educational modules for medical students and residents, cancer oncology fellows, where we used pieces of the interviews to express kind of key issues in listening to patients in the process of breaking bad news, living through treatment, transition from curative to palliative care, And there's also a module for families involved with caring for cancer patients. And a module that we're working on right now, which is the last of the five in the sequence, on spirituality and dealing with the spiritual aspects of illness as, again, as experienced through the patients, what the patients believe, hope for, pray for, you know, how their religious and spiritual lives interact with their treatment. So that's the basic outline of the project. And as Laura said, there's you can see a sample module on the website that she sent out. You can see some stuff about the project background. And you can also see the play that we made out of the narratives, the stories that the patients told. And let me talk about that a little bit, and then we'll just lay it open to questions. Because the interviews were based on a model of the hero's journey, we felt it would be an interesting project to translate those interviews back into performance. And the way we structured it was actually very exciting, because it laid out a kind of a template or a model for turning illness stories into very classically structured mythic journey tales. And the structure goes like this. We took the interviews and basically broke them into five pieces. The first piece is precursors, foreshadowing, but from the point of view of innocence, before the diagnosis, a story about the life lived in its sort of steady state or its original innocence. And that's story number one, with usually some precursors or foreshadowing of what's to come. The second story is the determining encounter, or the call to adventure in Campbell's terms. The revelation of the illness and the kind of thunderbolt from the blue that this usually is. And the period that is as part of that determining encounter, there's usually some period of uncertainty. There's a visit to a physician. There's some kind of test. There's some sense that there's something wrong, but there's not a clear sense of just what. There's that dread, but there's also hope. And finally, that diagnosis is made, and that sets the patient's life on a different course, at least for a period of time. The diagnosis becomes a different, there's a different person there. And Susan Sontag, in her book, Cancer is Metaphor, she kind of summed that transition up. She said, "Illness is the night side of life, a more onerous citizenship. Every person who is born holds dual citizenship in the kingdom of the well and the kingdom of the sick." And the diagnosis is an initiation into the kingdom of the sick. So the period, that's the separation in the old rites of passage model, and the treatment is the initiation. And it begins with the end of uncertainty, the certainty of the diagnosis, the gathering of helpers, which is a very fairy tale or mythological pattern. And the helpers come in three forms: the medical helpers, the oncologists, the surgeons, the nurses, the radiologists, that whole medical team. There's the family helpers, and those are pretty critical: spouse, parents, siblings, friends, children, and community. And then slightly more removed but often as important, the spiritual helpers, whether those are pastors, spiritual counselors, guides, books, tapes, inner resources, meditation practice, prayer, things that help keep the consciousness centered while going through this road of trials, these torments. And the trials in cancer treatment are pretty classical, mythological trials. They are woundings and torment and confinement. Nothing could be more mythic than those those things, the cutting of the body, the torment, both physical, emotional, spiritual, and financial, and confinement for long periods, either in hospitals or at home, in bed. And those, again, are classical markers of the transformation of consciousness, often not seen in that way, but it's hoped that the act of telling the story as a narrative from beginning to end gives the patient a chance to experience that. We don't actually tell them this is what you're going to experience when you tell this story, but there's something about the storytelling process that structures the experience in a way that echoes those mythic stories of many, many cultures. And whether the patient recognizes that consciously or not, they're still participating in that pattern. And ethically for us, we try not to impose that framework on their storytelling, but we're open to hearing it that way and letting them come to that realization in a kind of gradual unfoldment. And finally, the third phase, the return in the rite of passage model, is in the medical model, is called outcomes, and that's either homecoming or homegoing, remission and recovery, or acceptance of a terminal outcome, or denial, or all the phases and stages of that. And so there it is, and there's no illness that has that hero's journey in such a concentrated, epic form as cancer. Heart disease, diabetes, ALS, MS, other kinds of long sieges of illness have different contours and also different metaphoric and poetic character. But cancer is a concentrated dose of the hero's journey in the most formally kind of powerful framework. And so it becomes an extraordinary occasion for storytelling and for listening. So that's kind of a half hour there. There's a nice quote that we like to offer people in both in the interviews and in talking about it and in presenting about it, from Rachel Naomi Riemann, where she said, "The power in suffering to promote integrity is not only a Christian belief, it has been a part of almost every religious tradition. Yet 20 years of working with people with cancer in settings of unimaginable loss and pain suggests that this may not be a teaching or a religious belief at all, but rather some sort of natural law. That is, we might learn it not by divine revelation, but simply through a careful and patient observation of the nature of the world. Suffering changes the life force, sometimes into anger, sometimes into blame and self-pity. Eventually, it may show us the freedom of loving and serving life." So, if people want to hit their star sixes or whatever it is, I'd love to hear from you and talk with you.
Thank you, Joseph. I think we could just, if anyone has a question.
It's fascinating. Thank you. Think of a question.
Gail, the modules that you're developing, Joseph, are they for use in medical training, or are they for use?
They're primarily for medical students and oncology residents and fellows.
Mm-hmm.
They're fairly embedded in the medical school curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about the practicality and the desirability and efficacy of putting together modules or at least a module for patients themselves, and there's a lot of interest in that. We've written one grant to this new patient-centered outcomes research initiative that's under the Affordable Care Act to try and fund that. It didn't get funded on the first try. We might need two more cracks at it to actually get it. But we've also talked about doing some kind of book that's more of a trade book or, you know, popular book, using the interviews and the formal aspects that we've identified and some of the issues that we've talked about as a kind of a dialogue between doctors and storytellers, really. And that's something I'm very interested in doing at some point when we finish the actual modules themselves, which are each one a kind of a interesting set of production problems in themselves. And they have to be tested and they have to be evaluated according to the terms of the grant, you know, in very quantitative methodologies.
So not so much thinking of it for the patients themselves?
Well, that would be a separate module, really. The five that we're funded for are specifically for medical education.
Right.
But there's nothing to stop us except, you know, at esteem. I mean, Forrest, who's really the heart of the grant on the medical side and also has the linchpin job of principal investigator, has a progressive Parkinson's condition, which is slowing him down considerably, and he's actually going to retire from the grant at the end of this fiscal year. So as of June 30th, he's going to be in the background, and the rest of us. And unfortunately, it's a rather large group, so there are people ready to pick up the cudgels and keep going. But that's a big. He's been a big part of it. It's going to take a lot of extra energy mustered on all hands to you know keep it going over the, at least over this first goal line, which is five educational modules. That's where our funding runs out. So if we're going to do something else, it'll have to be in a separate process.
Miss Laura, I was actually curious about the interviews were done really for the benefit of the team. But how did people respond to being engaged in the interviews and then receiving the CD of their interviews?
Well, we had very positive responses from people. People used them. Some people, it varied, really. Some people really enjoyed them, used them with family. Family oftentimes watched them after the patient was gone to remind them of the vitality and the person that they loved. We had a very interesting experience in my family with my dad's interviews. Kind of a funny little story, but right around the time, Dad had bladder cancer, and right around, he was doing very well with that psychologically. He's a very strong-minded person. But at some point, they had to put the catheter in, and he lost his mind, which sort of makes you wonder where the mind is located. But after that, he lost track of what was going on, and he would ask, "What's going on? What they say I have cancer, but there's no proof. I don't see any proof here. Where are the nurse's notes? Where are the who says that I have cancer?" And we try to explain this to him. And finally, one day, I brought down the DVD of the interview and said, "Dad, we have proof here. Would you like to see it?" He said, "What kind of proof?" I said, "This is you talking about your cancer." I said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah, would you like to watch it?" "Absolutely." So we popped it in the DVD, and he watched it, and he was fascinated. He said, "Can you believe this?" "It's the damnedest thing I ever saw." You know, we took it out, and he said, because he had really declined treatment. He said, "I'm 87 years old, how much more pleasure do I have in saving my own life? So he resisted treatment. His girlfriend was trying to get him to go the whole hog, you know, have the bladder removed, do all that stuff, wear a bag. To him, that was abhorrent. So he really preferred to die. But then when it came to that point where the dying process really began to accelerate, he lost track of that. And we used the DVDs to sort of help remind him of who he was and where he was. So that was just one way. You know, we had many different kinds of people that participated in the interviews. And one kind of person that we had, we specifically tried to get storytellers who had experienced cancer. And, you know, because we were looking at the texture of the narrative as well as the experience itself, but how the experience was transformed by the storytelling process. And so we had, you know, Laura and Diane and Lisa, what's the last name of that lovely person from South Carolina who had had some kind of precursor leukemia problem that was cured by this brand new drug. I think the one that they just rejected for evergreening process there in India. She told her story about that. An incredible woman that not a lot of people in the storytelling world knew, but her name is Jo Carson. And Jo had colon cancer and had the most extraordinary experiences in living through it, living and dying with that. But, you know, she was a visionary and a very someone who listened to her dreams, and her stories about her experience with cancer were rather amazing. If anyone wants to look one of them up, she has a piece called The Run to the River Styx. It's on Vimeo. You could look it up. Just Google Jo Carson Run to the River Styx. And you'll see her reading the piece that she told to us in our interview. And it's just extraordinary.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, just to give you a kind of preview, she was in a coma, a chemotherapy, a radiation-induced coma. And she saw herself come to this place, a lake in Carter County near where we live, except in her vision it was the River Styx, and she came to the edge of the water and she looked into it and she saw forms floating in the water of whole and broken souls. And what the message that she heard from the water was, these are the whole souls are those who have put their stories together. And the broken souls are the ones who could not do that. And if you die now, if you have your, this is your choice. You can cross, you can go into the water, but if you do, you'll be among the broken souls. And so she came out of it and told that story.
Joseph, this is Gail again. What are some of the outcomes that are trying to be achieved for the medical people who will take these
trainings
that are measurable?
Yeah. There are a series of teaching points in each module, and those medical communication points are very much set by Forrest. He is the kind of guiding intelligence behind the medical communication points in the modules. And, for example, breaking bad news is all about giving the patient space to hear, to ask questions, and to grieve, to express their feelings. Not to just race through the diagnosis and hurry out of the room without really encountering the patient's feelings. It's very much about being focused, not being inconsequential, but leaving the patient space to respond, to assimilate, to express their feelings, and to receive what they need from the physician. To not violate the hope honesty continuum. There's a whole, and also to listen to the type of information the patient needs in their particular personality structure. So some patients really want to hear hopeful information and don't want to hear statistics. Other patients are, you know, that are more kind of rationally oriented. They want to say, you know, what are my odds, doc? Is it 50-50? Is it, you know, 10%? But other people just don't want to hear that at all. And so you have to, so asking questions to determine what communication styles the patient prefers. And that's a very delicate process. So we give interview clips from the patients talking about their own preferences, and we also do some mock-up scenes, some sort of standardized patient themes that the users of the modules get to evaluate the doctors in the sketches, in these filmed scenes to determine how well they think they did with those particular teaching points.
And then are there measurements for then how well these doctors take
in? Yeah,
there's
a whole set of evaluating points where you try and you know, the coders, the people who are evaluating the student's performance have to employ certain kinds of measurement strategies and evaluation strategies. That's pretty elaborate, and I have not myself, I haven't been involved with that directly. That's been kind of the doc's business to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Although some of our graduate students have gone pretty much full immersion in some of that stuff.
So when they're training doctors, they're watching videos, they're receiving...
The modules are a series, they're basically a PowerPoint format.
Uh-huh.
Where there's a series of slides giving teaching points, they have embedded video clips from our interviews, and then they have these scenes and evaluation points, a set of evaluation questions. How would you do this? What did the doctor in the clip do well? What did they not do well? And at the end of it all, there's what they call an OSCE, which is another evaluation thing. What they do is they administer the OSCE, the standardized exercise with these communication points, to the med students before they do the module and after they do the module, and determine whether they've improved.
Mm-hmm.
And generally they do.
Mm. So there's a before and after, yeah.
How soon after? Is it immediately after the module, or is there a period of time?
Yeah, fairly quickly. That we don't want the we don't want the good stuff to fade away.
Right.
That's
and
a
is
suspicion.
There any thoughts to then, after they've had experience, to go back and say, did that make a difference, and has it changed your practice?
Oh yeah,
and
exactly. That's the whole point. Is to develop some quantitative and qualitative data about that. These NIH grants you do not get unless you have a very clear, well-defined evaluation process. And that's really the province of the doctors, the medical people. We have a couple of research evaluation methodology specialists on the team, one of whom is taking over now from Forrest Lang as he pulls back. So that's pretty critical to whether ETSU ever gets another of these grants too, is if they fulfill the terms of the grant to the letter.
Right.
I have a question, and this in with is a storyteller's question.
Yeah.
So thinking about what Joe Carson said about broken stories and stories.
Yeah.
Did you see a difference between people who gave a narrative shape to their experience from people who just had a litany of events or sort of,
yeah.
or
yeah.
do people always have a narrative
yeah.
form?
Yeah, I definitely did. I mean, there were some interviews that were really fairly dull in the sense that the person didn't really seem to have a grasp of what they were, what was happening to them. The events had just sort of happened to them, and they were almost like hardly participating, and they didn't know what to do about any of it. I mean, some of those, that I remember there was an interview with a guy who had had a brain tumor, and maybe it was a consequence of the location and the type of cancer that it was, but he seemed utterly adrift in the interview. And had no agency, and other people, I'm thinking, you know, as a kind of study, it would be very interesting for me to write about just that question. And maybe you want to participate in this too. The narratives of the storytellers were really vigorous and vivid, and you know, even there were some of those. You know, we had a number of. Storytellers who lived through and were in full remission, which is certainly encouraging to people. But we also had people who were like Joe Carson, who was not going to live, but her narrative was so stunningly passionate and powerful and imagistic and full of poetry, and that's a function of how she lived her life before she had the cancer.
Right. And is the telling of the story, the capacity to tell the story, affected by the way the interview was conducted?
Well, we conducted the interviews pretty much the same way. I mean, there was an interview protocol that was established in advance, and we had a number of different people giving the interviews, and some of those, you know, their personalities were quite different. The graduate assistant who did many of the first 40 interviews was a real kind of earth mother type, a very compassionate, much more emotive, empathic individual. And then the graduate student who came on a little later and did many of the second half of the interview set was a little more dry and objective and distanced. But I think the kinds of responses we got really had more to do with what the patient brought, because the protocol was the same. The questions asked, the journey that the interview took the patient on was the same.
And how much of the of this are you able to share at this point, Joseph? Is the protocol available? Can people look at it?
I guess so. I mean, I have no reason to withhold it.
I would be curious.
Yeah. I don't think we want to, you know, widely publicize it, because we really need to publish some
right.
stuff from it first. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain, I'd want to, you know, the only stipulation I'd make is, you know, please don't publish this or take it on.
Right.
You know, do your own thing and write the book.
Right.
We needed to do that. There was an enormous amount of creative work and effort that went into producing that and producing the grant that was based on it.
Mm-hmm. And has there been, I mean, it's way early, and this that you're doing is huge all by itself. And is there any thought about the usefulness of some of these protocols for mm-hmm. other situations,
oh, very much
other than
so.
Cancer, for Parkinson's, for Alzheimer's, for heart disease?
I think that each of those would have to be approached separately. I mean, I think cancer is, there are many different kinds of cancer, and
right,
there are some
certainly.
That are approached these days as a chronic disease that's manageable rather than acute, but the whole affect and social approach to cancer, societal approach, I don't mean social like, you know, let's get together and have cancer, but the societal image, the imago that cancer occupies in the collective imagination is so much of a kind of an emergency, a warfare. I mean, war is the principal metaphor in response to the cancer. Whereas, you know, there's not a real war on MS out there, or even a war on diabetes. I mean, these are distinctly chronic illnesses that require a different sort of narrative arc. So you'd have to just examine those in some different ways, really approaching the poetics of these diseases. What are they about? What are the images that float around in the collective consciousness about these different illnesses? And a lot of them have to do with social class, lifestyle, habits. But you know, some of them are they're also, you know, deeper kinds of stories attached to them that you'd really want to go into in some analytic and emotional depth to respond adequately.
Joseph, I wanted to take a moment to ask if there are anyone on the line who has a question or a reflection or a response who hasn't spoken, who wanted to pipe in.
Mike Seliger here. Just the questions that you, the things you just mentioned about social class, et cetera, were you finding differences in the ways that people were responding and were responded to by the practitioners based on class and other cultural differences?
Yeah, very, very big differences. I don't know about responded to by the practitioners, because I wasn't on, I didn't witness the treatment that people had, but I heard the stories. And people, you know, this is Appalachia, so there were a number of patients who come from economically disadvantaged and culturally disadvantaged positions. And their responses were quite different. Their responses to the doctors, their responses to the illness, and there were also people from a more kind of economically prosperous situation who have different assumptions and about what their entitlements are with the medical system. But you know, cancer is also a great leveler. So
yeah. That. Do you think that what you're describing can be replicated in other places, both within the States and beyond, with different kind of, whether there'd be different focuses because of those cultural differences?
Yeah, I'm sure there would. I mean, part of our motivation of this group was to deal with health disparities. Because Appalachia tends to have worse outcomes, more prevalence of disease than other regions and other cultural areas. So that's one of the questions that was motivating the study in the first place. And one of the areas for follow-up study as well. Because we'll have this enormous data set. We'll have, you know, over 100 interviews with patients and probably a dozen or two dozen interviews with physicians and other health practitioners. So, you know, there's a lot of follow-up stuff that could be done using those transcribed interviews. But yeah, I think it could be replicated, and it'd be very interesting to look at urban populations, to look at populations with a wider variety of immigrant groups. Yeah, lots of stuff. That's one of the things we're dealing with in our studies, because in our medical school, a lot of the physicians are immigrants. There's a large number of medical students from the Middle East, from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and we're looking at, and we have to look at the differences in their backgrounds and beliefs,
sure,
and kind of habits of mind as opposed to the patients. And in the spirituality module, we're trying to deal with that quite directly. How does a medical student from the Indian subcontinent deal with a charismatic Christian or a fundamentalist Baptist who's talking about what the role that the Lord plays in the cancer process, and to be able to listen neutrally,
right,
empathically, and allow the potential benefit of the belief set that the person's been baptized in, literally and figuratively, to allow that benefit to manifest, not to question it or cast doubt on it, but to be open.
Suspend bias.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Joseph, this is Diane. I think it's interesting that when you and Forrest did that workshop at the Healing Through Story conference in Minneapolis back in 2004, I had just gone through my cancer experience, and I told Dr. Lang about it at that time, and he said, "Can I interview you? My medical students need to hear this." And so it was interesting that he had asked me then, but by the time you actually did interview me, it was 4 or 5 years later, and I really had put the whole thing together in a story format already, just because that's what I do with everything. And as you've probably heard me say, my husband says, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, so everything looks like a story to me. And so when I put my experience together in a story way, it made more sense to me, I guess. And now that's what I do in cancer centers and with retreats and with cancer patients and all that, is help cancer patients do that, because I think that's a really vital thing. And I think that was probably the difference in the storytellers you interviewed and the people who had never thought about what they do as story. So it's been an interesting spin that I've taken on it just for my own use.
Well, we had some real good natural storytellers in the project.
Oh, yeah, I heard some of them.
Yeah, and I loved some of the things that people said. You know, there's this one guy, this real jolly Scotch-Irish redheaded fellow, who had prostate cancer, then he had bladder cancer, and he just kind of aced them all. He just said, "You put your faith in the right place, it'll be taken care of." And he just told these things beautifully, but with this wonderful twinkle in his eye, and some pretty horrible stories, like the doctor just snapped that catheter right out and didn't even feel it. That never happened to him before. And then one about having such intense pain that he just prayed to the Lord and said, "Lord, if you need to take me now, but take this pain," and then it was gone. So, some real wonderful kinds of personal miracles, and we've had some African American storytellers who predictably had much more hostile or difficult encounters with the medical system because of the financial and the lack of insurance, and some real hard ones. One lady who had, I think she had metastatic breast cancer, but she had a home health care worker visit her and just tell her there's nothing you could do about it because of your insurance situation and because of what the prognosis is. And she said, that woman said, "Don't let the door hit you in the ass when you get the hell out of here." She said, "Nobody tells me what my prognosis is but God." And that was that. But she was a great storyteller too.
I love the idea of patients hearing each other's stories.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was part of a group. We actually had a story circle where we had 5 different cancer patients talking in a kind of round robin. We've had a few of those, sometimes with a geographical focus, people in a particular neighborhood or area, and sometimes with a particular subspecies of cancer. There was a breast cancer support group. There have been church groups with different, you know, members of the same religious organization talking about experiences with cancer, a variety of ways these things break down.
You know, when I saw back my interview, I realized a whole area of my own denial and things about the experience that only when I listened back to the story did I see a certain pattern. And that was quite, you know, shocking, actually, in a good way, if it can be, but... That was a really interesting for me, an interesting part of the process.
Well, I think that speaks to how people use the videos. Very very much depends on their own situation and their own preparation. I mean, my father, at the point when he watched the video, was only able to realize what was happening. He wasn't at that point able to reflect on the kind of character that he was exhibiting and expressing in his stories. That was, you know, the emergency was too great. But, you know, from your particular treatment left you intact, you know, intellectually, emotionally, artistically enough to use the video in that way to have a rather subtle experience of what the story was trying to tell you.
How did it change you to see, to hear, and to witness over 100 interviews?
Well, for one, I haven't witnessed the whole 100. We have a big team, and I think my this most recent graduate student, you met Kathy Jansen, right? Very talented person. She has gone from interviewer to transcriber and coder, and she's helped develop the modules. So she's probably seen more interviews than I have in the course of this. But, I mean, it really is an encounter with the mysterious and the kind of ineluctable fate. Just the fact that when we got this grant, excuse me, I think probably my most powerful experience was the experience with my father. Because he's a pretty important figure in my life, and when that as that transpired, that took a lot of handling for during that time and for the next couple years thereafter. Direct impact, and it felt like the grant was part of that whole experience, the grant and the interviews and the work that we were doing with cancers, like, visited not directly upon me, and that it wasn't my cancer, but it certainly was a very good experience. You all out there?
Yeah.
Yeah, thinking.
It's a very powerful statement to have an encounter with the mysterious.
That was my father's statement, I think, too. He said cancer is an encounter with the unknown, with the infinite. That's true. It happens on a microcosmic level within the body, which the body is essentially the field of the unconscious. We're so we spend so much of our lives unconscious of the life of the body, especially in our this culture where we can spend months at a time without really using it, sitting in front of a monitor, or what do they say about the body in academia as a transport mechanism from taking the head from one meeting to another.
Part of the goal of the modules is to expand the awareness of medical students to become more sensitive and compassionate. Has that occurred? Is there any example of that because they are working with the modules?
Well, you know, I think that's the goal, and that's part of the data that we are evaluating with these OSCEs and the whole testing procedure. And the feedback we're getting is positive, but it's not my province. So I haven't been I haven't been interviewing any medical students. I haven't even been talking to any of the people that have been taking it. So I think that would be a good thing for me to do, to get some direct testimony and some stories, because that's the way I put it together, like the rest of it, of the people on this call. If it isn't a story, it isn't quite real. If it's just data or statistics, it doesn't have the kind of life that one good story would give it. So let me report to you next time when I have some of that data.
Great.
That's excellent and really big food for contemplation.
Mm-hmm.
And is it possible for us to post, when we post the recording, which we're going to do, can we also post this template of the hero's journey, or is that also something you'd like to keep for the publication now?
Let me think about that, if you don't mind. And maybe I have a meeting on Friday with some of the group, and maybe talk that over with them, because, you know, dissemination is an important objective of the grant. So we definitely want the information to be out there, and we want people to be able to use it. We want it, you know, we want credit at the various levels that we feel like we deserve it for coming up with some of this stuff. And we also want to publish, and so we don't want to jump the gun on that.
It is after 10 o'clock, Joseph.
Right.
So I think, I think on behalf of everyone, thank you so very, very much for such really contextual and clear and very moving talk and response to questions.
Thank you. And I really recommend Joe Carson's talk, that The Run to the River Styx, and anyone who's, you know, we heard that from her in her living room, but she's reading it as a piece, one of her last pieces to the group at Alternate Roots, the theater conference, and it's quite beautiful.
Maybe we can post that. And
definitely post the link.
What is the name of her? Is her book Spider Insights?
Spider Speculation.
Spider Speculation.
Spider Speculation. That's also a gorgeous book on story for anyone who's not familiar with her work. So, Allison?
Yes.
This is your moment to unplug the recording.
I will.
Thank you, Allison.
And thanks so much, everybody, for tuning
in.
Yeah,
thanks to everyone who stopped in.
Thank you
so
Joseph.
Much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Talk to you all later.
Thanks. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.